what is gluten? It's, you know, we talk about gluten-free, we have gluten-free foods, and it's kind of a buzzword, so to speak.
Yeah.
What actually is gluten, and why is it a problem for some people?
So it's really become something that a lot of people are doing. Many people say, oh, well, but isn't it healthier? And it depends on where your perception of health is coming from. If you are ill and you've got conditions where gluten is actually giving you symptoms, then if you're going to be taking that gluten away, that's going to be making you feel much healthier. But if you're just listening into this story and thinking, oh, gluten's healthier, I've got to go out and avoid gluten, then it's not necessarily going to be beneficial for you. Some people do it to lose weight and they say, oh, I've lost weight because I'm on a gluten-free diet. A gluten-free diet, once the first 6 months you're over it and then you're kind of thinking, all right, now I'm going to go out and buy gluten-free cheese or some gluten-free Tim Tams and gluten-free everything else, you actually end up gaining more weight. That initial weight reduction probably comes because you're in a social setting now and you've avoided gluten, so there's a whole lot of wheat-based foods that you would normally hoe into that you're not hoeing into anymore. So from that, is it healthier? A gluten-free diet in general does lack a number of nutrients. And if somebody needs to be gluten-free from a medical perspective, then they really should speak to a dietitian and work out, where am I going to get these things that are deficient?
So the place I want to start off in is 2012. This is a bit about my story and my journey around gluten. It's a very short one, but it kind of sets the tone for what I feel to be the general tone of the gluten-free space and maybe a little bit of celiac disease, which we can touch on as well. There's an individual called Mark Hyman, and he wrote a book called The Ultramind Solution back in 2012. I remember reading that book when I was about 19 years old, and I was experiencing a few different health things at the time. And one of the things he recommended was dairy-free and gluten-free. And for me, I saw a shift in the culture and also in my life as well, about people always speaking about gluten, to avoid gluten, that gluten's bad for you. It doesn't matter if you have celiac or not, or if you're sensitive to it, it's not good for your body. So I guess I want to start with just, what are some of the stories, myths, whatever you want to call it, around gluten, and how should one see it? Maybe from the side of, if someone genuinely feels they're sensitive to gluten, then from the side of just general health and well-being.
So there are a lot of messages out there, and because of these messages, we've also got, you know, celebrities that are endorsing these messages, and as a result, there's about 30% of Australians and Americans that are actually reducing or totally avoiding the gluten. So it's really become something that a lot of people are doing. Many people say, oh, well, but isn't it healthier? And it depends on where your perception of health is coming from. If you are ill and you've got conditions where gluten is actually giving you symptoms, then if you're going to be taking that gluten away, that's going to be making you feel much healthier. But if you're just listening into this story and thinking, oh, gluten's healthier, I've got to go out and avoid gluten, then it's not necessarily going to be beneficial for you. Some people do it to lose weight and they say, oh, I've lost weight because I'm on a gluten-free diet. A gluten-free diet, once the first 6 months you're over it and then you're kind of thinking, all right, now I'm going to go out and buy gluten-free cheese or some gluten-free Tim Tams and gluten-free everything else, you actually end up gaining more weight. That initial weight reduction probably comes because you're in a social setting now and you've avoided gluten, so there's a whole lot of wheat-based foods that you would normally hoe into that you're not hoeing into anymore. So from that, is it healthier? A gluten-free diet in general does lack a number of nutrients. And if somebody needs to be gluten-free from a medical perspective, then they really should speak to a dietitian and work out, where am I going to get these things that are deficient? So one of the really big ones that become deficient are the B vitamins, because in a wheat-containing diet, the breakfast cereals, the breads, they're all fortified. So in goes iron, niacin, riboflavin, panathenic acid, you know, zinc. It goes into that. And I could send a wheat eater to you know, breakfast cereals and breads and get probably 30% of their daily intake from fortification. That is not in gluten-free foods. So people with celiac disease who, you know, are strictly gluten-free for life really need to work out, well, where is this coming from? But they're, you know, one of the other big things is fiber. So if you're going to take a wheat bread out, which is almost 100% wheat, now it might not have the best fiber in it because it's white bread, but it's got protein, it's got fat, it's got vitamins and minerals, it's got all those things added. And you add in a gluten-free bread, that bread is a high proportion of starch, which is an ingredient that's been stripped of nutrients. There's no protein, there's no fat, there's no vitamins and minerals, there's no extra vitamins and minerals that have been added or fortified. Sometimes you've got a white rice flour that's been put in there or some soy flour, but that's like a very small percent of the overall product that you're eating that's going to be giving you nutrients. So the fiber component is right down on gluten-free diets, and this is going to impact microbiome health, which is, you know, where we're all talking about at the moment for health in general. You know, there's other nutrients as well. I'm not sure if I need to go into all of the nutrients at this point. Tell me if you want to, but I mean, it could end up just being all about the different nutrients in a gluten-free diet. But, you know, iodine, iron, people who go gluten-free are often like yourself. You said you went dairy-free at the same time. So if you're taking out dairy-free, you lose a good a portion of protein and you lose your best source of calcium. So even though vegan food is on the rise, these do not replace the calcium that dairy replaces. So there's a lot, you know, and I say vegan food because that's the alternate dairy products that a lot of people go to when they're trying to, you know, take dairy out. Many could sort of just go lactose-free and keep that dairy, calcium component in, and it would probably be good. So you can see I can pull apart the diet in a lot of different ways. And that is why if gluten-free is something that somebody needs to be having or they're dedicated to do for a whole variety of different reasons, they really should see somebody about what are the nutrients so that you know, well, where can I find them on a gluten-free diet? And essentially, those things will come through the less processed foods. So you may need to change the style of eating to include these things instead of just trying to swap out a wheat food and put in a commercial processed food to replace it.
And so just to, I guess, set the stage for those listening, what is gluten? It's, you know, we talk about gluten-free, we have gluten-free foods, and it's kind of a buzzword, so to speak.
Yeah.
What actually is gluten, and why is it a problem for some people?
So gluten is a protein. So it's found in dominantly wheat, rye, and barley, very controversially in oats. In this country, we still include oats in the mantra of what is gluten-containing. Then there's also one that's called triticale, which is a hybrid of wheat and rye. And there are a number of different proteins that make up your total protein. And in wheat, 80% of the total protein is gluten. You know, by comparison, what they're deeming in oats, it's only about 5 to 10%. So it's very, very different. So this gluten protein in people who have celiac disease, it is ultimately responsible for setting up an immune response in the small intestine. So that means if we eat food, we swallow it down, you know, it goes through the esophagus, goes through the stomach, and then it becomes a liquid and it gets released into the small intestine. So think of that as a garden hose that's wound up inside of you. And it's, you know, it's round and all the food goes down through the middle of that intestine. And around the intestine, like all the way through it, you've got these finger-like projections. And these finger-like projections are what we call villi. And on these villi, we've got these mechanisms that can help us absorb our food. So imagine this mechanism grabbing the protein in the food as it passes, grabbing the calcium, grabbing the iron, grabbing the zinc, and it pulls it through and puts it into the bloodstream. And then that takes it off to where we need it in the body. So with celiac disease, people are losing those villi. And if you lose that villi, you lose the ability to draw all the nutrients out of the food. And so this can end up with multiple sort of medical conditions that could be an outcome of this throughout the lifespan. And then there's a whole lot of symptoms that can come along with that. And the symptoms are extremely variable. And there are people who have gut-centered symptoms, which meaning it could be things like the nausea, vomiting, pain, wind, bloating, cramping, diarrhea, constipation, and back and forth on any of those things. And they can be incredibly intense. Or you can have people who will get the brain fog, the absolute fatigue. They want to come home and go to bed at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, or they can't get out of bed until 11 o'clock in the morning. Migraines, mood swings. There are people who get skin rashes. And the one that's called celiac disease of the skin is dermatitis herpetiformis. So these symptoms that are outside of the gastrointestinal tract are becoming more dominant. So more people these days are thought to have that. So all those symptoms I described can also be experienced by people who we would term as having a non-celiac. I'm going to say wheat sensitivity, not gluten sensitivity. We used to say gluten because we just blame gluten in wheat for everything. But we now know there's about four components that could be a problem. So in these people, they get the exact same intense symptoms. And for them, they also need to avoid or reduce gluten. So there is a difference between the groups. Because people with celiac disease do get this villi damage as well, even if they're not particularly symptomatic, they have to avoid it very strictly because the gluten is going to damage their villi. And so they have to have good nutrient absorption for their foods, which will help them to decrease medical problems that could arise in the future if the villi remain damaged. Whereas people who don't have celiac disease but have all those symptoms, they're avoiding gluten to the level of their symptoms, which means that they can reduce it and live it. It's a different level of avoidance.
And so speaking into that and to the symptomology of it, so what are some early warning signs that individuals with, I guess, A, celiac disease, and then B, just gluten sensitivity, or in the words that you might use, wheat sensitivity. Mm-hmm. What are the early warning signs that one should look out for? And then also, I guess, to kind of add to that as a way to remove cognitive dissonance, what are some early warning signs that are in alignment with those symptoms, but maybe are something else?
Those symptoms can be many, many things. So the same set of symptoms could be either of those two diseases. They could be autoimmune diseases. They could be cancer. They could be pregnancy. They could be, a whole variety of different things. So I can't really list signs that say this means that it's celiac disease, because all of those symptoms could, you might just have migraines for some other reason. But you're getting migraines as a result of gluten as well. So pretty much there's any of those symptoms that I mentioned, if they're being persistent or they're sort of not going away, you need to go to a doctor and try to work through it. So you don't automatically say, oh, this is food intolerances, I need to go and see a dietitian and find out what foods are affecting me. You actually need to find out if there is a medical reason for any of those symptoms. And that means first you trip to the GP, and please don't take gluten out of the diet. If you take gluten out of the diet thinking that's going to make you better, you can no longer test for celiac disease. You actually have to have that in your diet, because that's what's stimulating the villi to become damaged, and that causes particular blood antibodies to be raised. And we want to check for those blood antibodies. We want to check for that villi damage in order to diagnose celiac disease. So when the GP might think, oh, I need you to go and see a neurologist, or you need to go and see a gastroenterologist, or you need to go and see a dermatologist, depending on the presentation of the symptoms, those particular specialty doctors will then work through, and you know, if they find that there's a particular disease, then they may say, right, well, we can treat it doing this, and then all the symptoms may disappear. If they diagnose celiac disease, well, then we know that we need to look at a gluten-free diet. But if celiac disease isn't diagnosed and you've still got all those symptoms, you've probably got a whole lot more tests with different doctors. And then basically when it says, okay, we've ruled out any diagnosable disease that we can treat, that's generally when people start to say, right, let's address the diet and see what we can do from a diet perspective.
Okay, then. And so if you look at currently what's happening in, and again, I'm looking at the trends that I see, and this is just my perception, but you see a lot of individuals who are maybe becoming health coaches and falling into the space of what I would term as, and again, I don't think that everyone can fit inside of one bucket, but correlation rather than causation, right? Mm-hmm. So on that note, when you think about, say, someone saying, oh, you just remove gluten, remove all these different foods, and why is self-assessment, not just with celiac or with gluten sensitivity or, you know, wheat sensitivity or anything like that, why is self-assessment risky, and why should one avoid it? And what are the steps that someone should take to really remove that bias of correlation versus causation?
If you are just sitting here with a set of symptoms and you just immediately go to diet, if there is an underlying disease, you're missing getting that diagnosed. And if you've got an underlying disease, you want to get on top of it sooner rather than later, so that it doesn't progress to being worse by the time you end up recognizing it and then having to do something about it. So that's always the reason to, you know, ask the doctor first. In terms of self-taking, yes, a lot of people just go gluten-free, dairy-free. But I've kind of worked in the area of food intolerance for a very long time. And there are multiple things in food that can be an issue. And, you know, once upon a time, we would just sort of jump straight into sort of food elimination diets. And these days, with all of the information we're getting about the microbiome and things that can affect that and then how that may affect health, the first point of call now is just, you know, are we having a diet that meets the healthy diet guidelines, which means let's throw out some of that processed food to start with, and get a healthier diet. And sometimes, you know, just manipulating people's diet, saying, let's do some more home cooking. Let's not have takeout every day for lunch. Let's prepare a lunch and take that with us. So we're cutting out burgers and fries and you know, these high fats that the takeaway fats that have been, sorry, the foods that have been cooked in sort of a lot of the omega-6 fats. And a lot of the processed foods, the highly processed foods, the foods that you might buy as a ready-made meal that you're just going to heat up, they've got, they're anti-inflammatory. And that if we can take a lot of this away, pull out the sugars, put in some good fats, put in some real fruit and vegetables. I mean, a lot of us have come from that English background where we've got the meat, the potatoes, very little vegetables on the plate, you know, huge amounts of meat on the plate. And there's a big turnaround now to try to get at least half a plate of vegetables and really looking at the benefits of what these can give. And sometimes the symptoms will disappear at that point, which means you can still eat all of your food groups, but the junk side has reduced greatly. And if you do that and then that doesn't help, then we can start to look at, you know, other things. And so there's dairy, there's wheat, there's FODMAPs, there's food chemicals, there's a variety of different things. And I guess one thing that I'm seeing a lot of misunderstanding with is allergy, because many people will say, well, then I have an allergy and I can't eat tomatoes because I have an allergy, or I can't eat oranges because I have an allergy. And there's a misuse of that term. Because a true food allergy, and everyone, you will know those kids at school who have peanut allergy or egg allergy or milk allergy, and a very small amount of it is enough to set off a reaction, which, you know, if it gets really bad, can affect breathing, the whole body can shut down, and there could be death. That is a true food allergy, which generally you start with young children. They grow out of it quite often in primary school years or beforehand. And the seafood and the peanut are probably the two they're less likely to grow out of. They might remain into adulthood. So we got really a lot of public statements in the 90s because all of a sudden peanut allergy was everywhere, and we needed people to know straight away that if you're got a school that's nut free, that you know, it's serious, that you shouldn't send your kids with a peanut butter sandwich. And that's around about the time food intolerances got more notice. I guess into the year 2000s it got better notice, because a lot of times in the past people were told, oh, it's all in your head, darling, go home, put your feet up, you'll be fine. And, you know, people got sick and tired of sort of hearing that. And now we recognise that these things are real. But that mixed message that the tiniest amount's going to set me off is the problem. So when people take things out, they want to do it to the nth degree, which isn't always sustainable. And sometimes I see a throwback from that is, yes, they are sensitive, and if you remove something to the nth degree down the track, sometimes you can react to much smaller doses of it. So you're better off in some instances, if you know, if the condition you've got allows it, is to try and actually leave a little bit of it in periodically.
And would you say that, so in nature, there's old friends bacteria, which is the bacteria that we're exposed to, as in the dirt, around animals, around environment. And do you feel that because of, I guess, I don't know what year it was, maybe it was the 1980s, 1990s, or even just before then, where germs were the worst, they were the enemy of everything. It's like, avoid germs, everything could be really clean. Do you think that this, like the hygiene hypothesis of everything being hygienic, do you think that's affected our immune system and lack of exposure to environment, to, you know, plants and trees and dirt and things like that?
Yeah, certainly with that peanut allergy, that real IgE-mediated allergy that I was just describing, one of the leading theories is that we are too clean now. And by being too clean, we have changed our internal environment, and we have changed the way that our body will respond to these components that they are now seeing in their diet, and they're becoming more reactive to it. As we've progressed along that theme, you know, there's a lot of talk now about the microbiome. And the microbiome are gut bugs and yeasts and things that live inside of us. Now, they will live on any of our surfaces, so they're going to be all through the gastrointestinal tract. But really, when people start mentioning them, they're talking intensely about the ones that are in the large bowel. So the large bowel is the section of the bowel after the one I described in the beginning for celiac disease. So celiac disease, where all those villi were, that's the small bowel, and the damage in celiac disease is in that part only. As the food gets through that, so in the small bowel, that's where we take all of our nutrients out. What remains in the food, which is pretty much all of the different starches and fibres, that gets into the large bowel, and it's the job of the large bowel to start pulling some of that liquid out, concentrating it down and forming a stool that everyone can poop out. And the microbes that live in that environment, it's now thought to be, you know, like an entirely other organ. And the things that they're showing can change that microbiome is what is in our environment. So when we are too clean and we're even using all those cleaning disinfectants, those disinfectants are killing bugs. Well, they're on surfaces and things that we are eating and that's getting into us. And so they're killing bugs as well when they get down. But our gut is furnished by what is in the environment coming through us. So if we're in a totally clean environment, we are changing what is getting down into the bowel. And, you know, thinking about it as trees that you're planting in the bowel. So you've got this environment that you want to plant there that can be good for you, because they've been able to show that these bugs do things that are good for us. We don't have the ability to break down the fibers. They break down the fibers. From that, they produce vitamin K, short chain fatty acids, one of them called butyrate, which, you know, helps to feed the gut. And these things help to keep the liver healthy, the immune system healthy, the brain healthy. They can switch on and off genes, so they do have an influence in disease states. So there is a big look now at what is in our environment.
And so what can, I guess, before I go into that actually, I was going to ask, what can one do? So when we look at bacteria, they might be called lost bacteria, we go back to hunter-gatherer tribes, or rather we look at current day hunter-gatherer tribes and we assess their gut microbiome and we find things, bacteria like Lactobacillus rotari and Bifidobacterium infidus and things like that. And these bacteria that are responsible for helping us to maintain, or rather not maintain, helping us to increase longevity, healthier lives, thicker hair, things like that. In my studies, this is. And there's about 94, I think it's 94, 96%, either one of the two, of people that no longer have, for example, Lactobacillus rotari in their stomach anymore. How much of, when it comes to the gut and these lost bacteria from having an environment that's so clean, for lack of better words, how much of this is influencing, say, celiac disease or gluten sensitivity or even wheat sensitivity and things like that? Is it as a large amount, or is it just too hard to know right now?
We really can't answer that question in any definite way at this point in time. Mm-hmm. What we do know is that there is not one perfect microbiome. If I got on a plane today and went to South America, by the end of that week in South America, my microbiome will have altered because of my exposure then to what I was putting in my mouth while I was over there. That would, you know, change what was down here. And that doesn't mean that I'm now sick because I've gone somewhere else and my microbiome has changed. So there is a bit of a thought that there is a perfect microbiome and just tell me what that bug is and I'll put it in and everything will be fine. There isn't at this point a perfect microbiome. They know that there are particular species that seem to be more associated with health and then species that are more associated with people who are sicker. And they have been able, they've looked at children and they follow them over a period of time, and they've actually been able to show that the microbiome changes up to about 18 months before a diagnosis of celiac disease. And even when somebody is on a gluten-free diet, it improves, but it's not going to be exactly the same as a wheat eater, because the bifidobacteria is one that wheat will help to thrive, and that is something that is considered to be a good bug. So the bugs in the diets of people who are gluten-free, their microbiome is going to be different to wheat eaters, specifically because of the substrates in the foods that they're actually eating. And this is one of the issues with the fiber content. The gluten-free diets having this high starch, which is, you know, stripped of all other sorts of nutrients, is a very different method of delivering that particular food to the gut than if you're going to get it as a whole grain. So there are very much, you know, differences that we see in the microbiome. There's also a thought that we can overplant. So if we're going to say, right, you need to have heaps of bifidobacteria because we've considered that that's a good thing. If you throw that into an environment, so again, think about your forest where everything's in equilibrium, and then you throw in one thing that has the ability to just outgrow and take over, then you're going to change the rest of what's in the forest as well. So sometimes you might actually, with some of these probiotics that are taken, you might be giving it too much of the good thing, and therefore it is changing the different colonies that are living there.
And so one of the trends that I'm seeing as well is around, when it comes to chronic health issues, autoimmunity, or just issues in general, or people that want to be healthier, they're moving to a more carnivoric kind of diet, lots of meat, maybe some fruits, and you're seeing a lot of this online on social media and things like that. What are your thoughts on that first and foremost?
I'm not a big advocate of high meat diets. The high meat is the high protein, it's low fiber. If it's low fiber, it's not going to feed the microbiome. But, and so then if you're not going to be feeding the microbiome, you'll be definitely changing the bacteria, the yeast and everything that's in there. And is that going to be good or bad for health? We tend to be thinking about things in isolation, whereas disease comes from a combination of events. And one of the doctors that I've worked with sort of describes it as a piece of Swiss cheese. So Swiss cheese has got holes in it. And let's say one of those holes is a lot of bifidobacteria. One of them is a high meat diet. And then before we've got a low vegetable diet. We might have poor sleep. We might have a super stressed job that we're turned on all of the time. And you've got this surging stress that's coming through the system. You might do heaps of activity. You might not do enough activity. If enough of these holes all line up such that you can sort of put a pencil down through several of them, you'll say, right, now that's a disease state. So the disease state is not all because I've got the high meat diet or because I've got a heap of bifidobacteria. You know, all these things are going to be great. So two or three people or 50 or 100 people could all have a high meat diet and there might only be a disease state in one or two of those because in them, everything else that they were doing has lined up in such a way that, you know, they've ended up with the disease state. In working with people who have food intolerances, a lot of them do feel much better on lower fiber diets. So you have this message of what we're thinking is great for everything. But if you're going to be telling somebody who's highly symptomatic that they have to eat all of these fibers that they really, really struggle with, then, you know, their life is full of pain. So if they want to live a life without pain so that they can go out and do things and they've chosen to perhaps eat, a higher meat diet because of that, then, you know, their life is shaped by what helps them to be pain-free. Will that then line up some of these things so that down the track there may be a disease state that comes of it? Maybe in some and maybe not in others. People who just choose to do the meat thing because they think that it's healthier, we're all motivated by different things. So at the moment, you know, they're talking about that for perhaps Alzheimer's and having a higher fat diet. So I know a lot of people are going into that with high meats. But then you've got microbiome studies that come out that say that we need to have the fibers because then if we've got the right bugs growing in the biome, then that's going to help with mental health and we're not going to get the Alzheimer's. So you've got the messages on both sides coming through. There isn't any directive yet in science that basically goes, right, 90% of a great amount of studies are suggesting that we need to do this. We are still in a whole lot of information's coming through. And in the absence of having a direct idea, people will go, well, I'm going to grab onto this one and I'm going to do that. And there will be some research that says it's okay. And there's going to be some research that says it's not okay at this point in time.
Well, yeah, it's tough as well, because when individuals have these symptoms of, you know, chronic illness and experiencing a high amount of pain, it's very tough sometimes because you have all these things online saying, try this and then try this and try that. And then even offline as well, like in books and different ideas, and the books that sell the best are the ones that have the most controversial points of view, not always, but generally speaking, different diets and different, you know, extreme ways of living. And then when it comes to the medical system, sometimes very, very broadly, it can be tough because it feels like going around a medical merry-go-round, so to speak. Like you have one specialist saying one thing, one specialist saying another. So I guess the trouble is like, what does someone do who goes through these situations? Like they want to address it themselves, but then they go to someone and someone says one thing, another thing. Is there any, advice? I know this is probably off the topic of what we're supposed to speak about, but do you have any advice or thoughts or reflections on that and what someone might be able to do?
Look, I really don't think that I can add to that. When somebody, when there is an idea about what might benefit health, then people can often jump onto that and say, all right, well, I'm going to dedicate myself to that theory and I'm going to go with it. In the absence of the science being able to say that that's 100% what you should be doing, because to get to the point where you can make a statement that this is beneficial, there's years and years. You know, we're doing decades of research. So by the time there is an idea, then you've got to research it. But then if it's only one or two papers, and a lot of this are studies that have just started. So there might only be four papers out there, and two of them might be for it and two of them might be against it at this point in time. So you need to wait till there's 100 studies out there, and then you can get an idea of which percentage are down this track and which percentage are down that track to see. And the one that's got the bigger percentage is the way that the medical people are then going to say, well, look, this is where we should be going. But it could be decades to get to that point. So if you don't have decades to wait, then I completely understand why you then choose to follow something. And if it is a manipulation of the food, my thoughts are that you need to speak to somebody to make sure that whatever you're doing, you still need to have a balanced basic diet. So that's where a lot of the messages, specifically around dairy-free, is just lost. The whole calcium thing, you know, I can be standing in a supermarket and someone will go, oh, yes, I had some hummus this morning. I've, you know, got some calcium in that. And that might give them 80 milligrams of calcium and they might need 1,300 milligrams of calcium and they don't know it. And so, you know, they're going around with their tablespoon of hummus each day thinking they're covering their calcium needs and then end up with osteoporosis and go, oh, what? I thought I was right. So there are certain things in nutrition that need to be covered. And if you're going to manipulate a diet and you want to follow for whatever reason, I would say, you know, talk to somebody. But we don't have 100% for everything. You know, definitely do this and this is going to happen at this point in time. Depends on the
disease. What's one... Gotcha. Okay, so let's say someone... actually, before we get to that, what is one thing you wish everyone knew about gluten?
There's a lot of anxiety around gluten. And, you know, for instance, I've had someone say to me that the oat milk was in the container, you know, at a coffee shop, and they just tipped out the oat milk, didn't wash it, put soy milk in and got their soya latte. Then they said, well, I've been gluten from that oat milk and I've had to go and cancel my doctor's appointment to draw blood or to, you know, check for the villi because I've been gluten. So one of the big misunderstandings around gluten is that a crumb of gluten is going to totally wipe out my villi. And at this point in time, and again, there's controversy. There are researchers who won't say that 10 milligrams of gluten a day is safe for people with celiac disease, but that's what the whole international food standard has been based on in you know, all of Europe, Canada and the United States, that 10 milligrams a day in the background of a gluten-free diet is safe. So if you've got, you know, 1 mil, let's say, of oat milk left in that container, of that 1 mil, 10% is actually oat milk. Of that 10%, 14% is the protein. Of that protein, 5% of it is sort of avenin. And then the cross contact that might be in there. I mean, we're talking less than 1 milligram of gluten, you know, probably less than 0.00003 milligrams of gluten or something in there. And so when I teach gluten, I teach you know, gluten-rich, gluten-poor, gluten-free, and I try to say not all gluten's the same, not all exposures to gluten are exactly the same, to try to allow people to assess what it is that possibly had the gluten in it in the cross-contact sense and go, you know, put it into perspective to take that level of anxiety away, because they're definitely showing that anxiety is a component in if whether or not somebody reacts.
Okay, then. And so you said there are different types of gluten. Is that what I heard you say? Different types?
Different exposures to gluten. Yeah. So you said what is gluten in the first place? And gluten is a protein. So the protein is in the flours. So if you've got a food that's made from real wheat flour, so your pizzas, your bread, your cakes, your biscuits, real wheat flour's gone into that. That's a huge, huge exposure to gluten. You know, wheat bread, a piece of bread's got something like 63,000 parts per million of gluten in it, whereas the international food standard is 20 parts per million of gluten. So huge difference. So if we, you know, have a starch that's made from wheat, there's almost no gluten left in that. But it is detectable, and so people with celiac disease are told not to eat it. But there's a vast difference in the actual quantity that's going to come into your food. And in fact, most people are totally shocked when I tell them that prior to the year 2000, for 50 years, people with celiac disease were allowed to eat wheat starch. It was in every bread, every biscuit, every cake, every pasta that was made. And still, the research says there were heaps of people who villi grew back, they lost their symptoms, bloods were in the normal range. So, but then there were people in whom they were still ill, which is why come the 2000s, we said, right, well, we need to take that wheat starch out. But even so, there's a vast difference in the amount of gluten that you will get in any one hit. You eat a piece of bread, you will get damage to the villi from that. You eat wheat starch, some people do, some people don't get damage. So I try to teach people what we do know in the science to help address these highly anxious states they have about seeing gluten as exactly the same exposure level every single time they might, you know, come across it, especially in trace background cross contact.
So before the 2000s, would you mind just expanding on that? So what was different exactly?
So can I go back to the 50s and sort of explain a little bit? So
yeah, of course. Yeah,
when it was at the end of the Second World War, so the late 40s going into the 50s, when we were first able to show that it was gluten that led to the villi damage in celiac disease. So gluten is the protein that is in wheat, rye, barley, essentially. In oats, they weren't certain about what it was doing at that point, and they just told people to avoid oats. But there were no dietitians. There were no gluten-free food standards. People were just told, well, don't have the flour. So all of the things that had real flour in it, they weren't eating, but it was based on their symptoms. So if they didn't feel sick, they could eat a piece of bread at grandma's 90th birthday. Loads of people were still drinking beer. We didn't get a blood test until the 1970s. And so that was the first time we could then also measure what was happening in the bloods. And so how well people were was based on bloods and their symptoms. And wheat starch, it was the starch portion, the carbohydrate pulled out of your wheat flour. Gluten was the protein. So being the carbohydrate and not being able to directly measure gluten in those years, the wheat starch was deemed to be okay. And so wheat starch was used because it was the common starch. So it was used in breads, in breakfast cereals, in baked goods, in cakes, in pastas that were labelled and sold as gluten-free. And that happened right up until, well, it changed in all different countries. Australia was the first to make the change. So that's why I say roughly in the early 2000s, we changed in 1994 here in Australia, we pulled the wheat starch out because it was actually an Australian who came up with the test to be able to detect gluten in food, which is why we then put that to our food standard and we became the first to change the food standard and pull the starches out.
Okay, so did people have the same symptoms back then, or are you saying symptoms worsened over time? Or is it merely just the appearance of it in food?
You mean with having the starches in it?
I guess what I'm trying to go is, has gluten sensitivity become more as of lately, yeah, and because of that reason,
yeah,
or not?
Gluten sensitivity has increased about fivefold since the 50s. And back then, unless you had diarrhea, gut-type symptoms, and you were really underweight and skinny, then it wasn't recognised as celiac disease or, you know, sort of a gluten sensitivity. So what has changed since about the 80s is a recognition of headaches, migraines, mood swings, the skin, your dermatitis, herpetiformis, but even things, fertility. So there's about 20% of infertility. There's infertility in about 20% of marriages where there may be one or more people with celiac disease. So the gluten can affect the development of sperm. It can affect female fertility as well. So there's a whole lot of things that we have now recognised that could come back to, gluten, and whether or not there's any sort of association with autoimmune diseases is another one of those controversial topics where some people, you've got scientists that will be on the yes side and scientists on the no side, and the consensus at the moment falls down onto the no side in terms of there is no statement that because you have an autoimmune disease, going gluten-free is going to be beneficial, but individuals do note that that can be, you know, the same. So, yes, things have increased fivefold since about the 50s, and we have hybridized wheat at about that time as well, and we've, you know, the amount of gluten that's actually in wheat is 8 times greater than what it was 15,000 years ago when we first started to grow wheat back in the, you know, the Fertile Crescent. So perhaps there's an alignment with that is one of the, you know, the thoughts.
Why has it increased for, and would you, if you could make the choice, would you have less gluten in food overall? Is there any benefit to having it for the general populace?
Probably if I had the choice, I'd probably pull it back. But the reason it's increased is because it's a cheap grain to grow. It grows in a whole lot of different regions of the world. It's the biggest export. It has a mouthfeel that's very pleasant. So one of the things you have with gluten-free foods, with the high quinoa, high buckwheat, if we want to make it 100% because of the good fiber, very, very earthy, strong flavours that a lot of people draw back from. Whereas wheat is very pleasant and people want to eat it, so it's very popular. And once you have a farm size, if you want to increase the amount of wheat, you can't just go and buy more land. It's not there, which means the land that you've got to be able to produce more wheat on. So they hybridized it such that your head of wheat it doubled or even got bigger in the same land space, so that you could double the amount one farm could produce, and, you know, so double your income. But what happened is wheat used to be about 4 or 5 feet high. And so you ended up then with this really heavy head at the top, and it would break. And so the stem would break over, and then it wouldn't be able to feed the wheat crop up here. And so you would lose the whole crop. So then they hybridized it again. So now the modern wheat it's called dwarf wheat. It's around about 2 feet high. So it's got a thicker stem, a shorter stem, and it can grow. You've got all of this extra head of wheat on it, and you've doubled your crop. So it was hybridized not for nutrition purposes, but for the market purpose. And in doing that, you've changed the components that are within the wheat. So the components within the gluten have altered, and so we put it in so much more. And it's, we eat so much more bread and baked goods than we did if we go back to my grandmother's generation, you know, between the 1900s and the 1950s. And we can use many components within wheat to help produce foods that have good mouthfeel, and you know, manufacturers use it as an additive in a whole variety of different ways to improve, you know, textures and presentations of food. So not only are we eating more bread and baked goods, but we're also getting wheat in foods like ice cream, which isn't even a grain. Mm. And you think, oh my God, why is it in there for? Yeah, so we're eating a whole lot more of it, which is why there is a thought that that's contributing to, it's one of the components that is contributing to the breakdown in the gut health. But then there's all of, you know, there's so many other components that could be in our preservatives, in all of the different, you know, you put petrol in the car, you're exposing yourself to, you know, man-made petroleums. We've got plastics. You know, they're talking about microplastics in bottles of water if you leave the water in the car. So there's a whole lot of possibilities, and it also comes back to the stresses, how well you slept, the rest of your diet, as to whatever that the microbiome health and the health of the gut itself.
And so for those who think they might have wheat or gluten sensitivity, what steps should they take? Should they go see, you mentioned earlier, the GP? What's the kind of approach you'll take for that?
Yeah, I think people should start with a GP, and whatever, because the presentations of symptoms can be quite wide. And then if they then need to go to the specialist to hone down into whatever their presentation of symptoms might need to be looked at. And they need to cross off that they've got some organic disease that can be treated. And when they've done all of that and they're like, you know, we can't find anything that we can treat, but you've still got these symptoms. And then it's seeing, you know, a dietitian who may be able to then start with just what is healthy eating, let alone moving down into other investigations to see whether there are particular food intolerances that particular person may have. With an understanding, with an intolerance, is it's not an allergy, and it's let's reduce rather than totally avoid.
And just maybe we'll just go through that quickly. So when it comes to health and food, what is considered a healthy diet? I don't mean for the individual, I just mean healthy in general.
In general,
I remember the food charts when I was younger, but what is it now?
Yeah. In general, the Mediterranean diet is often the one that's put forward as being a very good diet to follow. It ticks a lot of boxes. It's anti-inflammatory, so that's all about these autoimmune diseases. It helps the heart. It helps metabolic health, which is about peaks in your blood sugar or falls in your blood sugar, insulin control. So the emphasis is basically a high fiber, and that is a lot of fruit and vegetables. And within your fruit and vegetables, it's talking about a lot of colour. So I don't know if you've heard the expression eat the rainbow, but, you know, at least three different, great, at least three different coloured vegetables on your plate at night time. And there's a bit of research that's gone into the purple pigment. The xanthionines, I think, are the name of of those particular pigments, and they're saying they are particularly good antioxidants that we should be having in our body. And those, you know, help to stop cells being broken down, the cell walls being broken. So colour, fibre. We want to have legumes and lentils. So again, a lot of fibre, and from the celiac perspective, there's a suggestion of having lentils and legumes each day because they've got these B vitamins in them that I've said we've missed sort of from fortification. We want olive oil. So the Mediterranean diet has a lot of olive oil. It's an omega-3 fat. It is a monounsaturated fat. The other healthy fats are omega-3 fats, and the omega-3 fats are, it's a particular type of oil. And when we are using a lot of commercially cooked processed foods. They use a lot of sunflower and safflower oil, which are omega-6. And these ones are not good for health. And what we've done is we've increased the quantity of that in our diet. So if we can pull back from that, we want to try and increase the omega-3 foods. So your fatty fish, avocado, nut seeds, those sorts of things that are going to come through there. Proteins, there's still protein in the diet, but it goes more towards heavier on seafood and not so much on the red meats. And eggs are still there and dairy is still there. So you're still wanting that dairy food because that's the best way to get your calcium, and you'll absorb it so much better through calcium foods, through dairy foods, than you do through other foods.
So the general advice would be, before you start to self-diagnose and say, I have this or that, the other, look at diet, look at sleep, look at the basics. When it comes to diet, you know, try to incorporate in some degree a Mediterranean diet, get your sleep right, stress levels and things like that. And then from there, if you still have symptoms, perhaps see a GP, perhaps see someone like yourself, and then that'd be the next step.
Yeah. Yeah.
Great. Awesome. And so can the general public come and see you directly, or do they have to go through a GP? What is the process if someone wants to come and see you and work with you?
Yes, they can come to me directly. They don't need to have a GP referral. There are care plans they can get through GPs that some people are eligible for. That's up to, it depends on their condition and the GP. But yes, they can contact me directly.
Okay, and so where can they contact you directly? Do you have a website or a number they can call?
My website is called glutenfreenutrition.com.au. And so my email is one of the better ways, is kim@glutenfreenutrition.com.au. And then I also have an Instagram account. So that is @drkim.glutenfreenutrition. And they're generally the ways that people start a conversation with me. I turn most people to email, and then we'll continue conversations there. I'll phone people from there and we'll make appointments, which a lot are online appointments. Some people do prefer face-to-face, but generally I see most people online these days.
And I'll add that all as well to the show notes. So if anyone wants to reach out, then they can just click there and go straight through. Awesome. Well, it's been a pleasure to speak with you, and I've learned a lot myself as well. And is there any final thoughts you wanted to add?
Oh, I think I've really spoken a lot. So, look, thank you. I think we did cover quite a bit of ground today.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Thanks, Kim.
Thanks, Luke.